The US president says Ukraine is moving to restore order as a major anti-terror operation continues in the eastern town of Slavyansk. Ukrainian officials say many pro-Russian militants have been killed. Barack Obama has been speaking at a meeting with the German chancellor.
It is obvious to the world that these Russian-backed groups are not peaceful protesters. They are heavily armed militants who are receiving significant support from Russia.
That's the latest.
Now remember, folks, I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm telling you what is taught in the mysteries. I'm telling you what our enemies believe. Make no mistake about it, they are our mortal enemies. They want to see us wiped off the face of the earth.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Dutch prince, who was really working for the Nazis all along, perhaps, and tonight the secret life of the Bilderbergs founder and the first chairman, Prince Bernhard. Well, most know him as being in the middle of the 1975 Lockheed scandal, where he took $1 million bribe for the Dutch Air Force to buy US fighters that promptly fell out of the sky. His name was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, but he wasn't Dutch at all. He was a German prince, and he joined the Nazi party while at university, quickly becoming an SS officer, before marrying into the Dutch royal family and supposedly switching sides during the war. But we know him on this show as the founder and the chairman for the first two decades of NATO's political lobbying arm, the Bilderberg Group, arguably the most powerful private club in the Western world, selecting everything from Secretary Generals of NATO, even possibly to Prime Ministers and Presidents, rendering our elections, some would say, pointless. Before he died back in 2004, he liked to describe himself as a loyal Dutch patriot. But according to Amsterdam journalist Philip Droche and author of the book Bernhard, Master of Spies, The Secret Life of Prince Bernhard, he remained embroiled in double dealing behind the scenes throughout his life. So I'm joined now by Philip Droche on the line. I hope I pronounced that right, Philip. Hello, Philip. Can you hear me? Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, it's about right. You better call me Philip. That's a lot.
Okay, I'll stop trying to do the Dutch accent and just call you Philip. Anyway, first of all, can you just tell us a little bit about Prince Bernhard's ancestry, where he actually came from?
He's actually from a little princedom in the east of Germany, which is no longer part of Germany now. It's now part of Poland. And he was a reasonably well-off prince. He started out his life as a minor prince, and then obviously after he married the crown princess of the Netherlands, he became a real prince. And he made a step up in life. It was the biggest decision he ever made in his life was to marry the Dutch crown prince.
Yes, he did very well there, what many would say, you know, get married right into the top of the Dutch royal family. But tell us about his early days at college and in the Nazi party, because he actually tried to deny that he ever was a member of the Nazi party during his college days.
Yes, he did. He did everything in his power to try to wipe that slate clean, so to speak. No, he studied law in Germany at Berlin University, and he always said his excuse for joining the Nazi Party was that because he was a student and because he wanted to do his exams, it was easier if he became a member of the Nazi Party, because only members of the Nazi Party were allowed to do those exams. But he did much more than just becoming a party member. He was a member of the SS. He was also before a member of the SR. So he has he was in the National Socialist Flying Corps, the precursor to the Luftwaffe. He was a member of the National Socialist Rally Club, supposedly because that entitled him to cheap fuel and even cheaper car insurance. So he was quite well connected within the Nazi Party.
But what about, what he would say was, look, I was only joining those to get ahead in life. I didn't believe in it at all.
Yeah, well, that is a theme in his whole life, that he always tried to do things to get ahead in life. He was an opportunist, And he always tried to do the right kind of thing in the right circumstances, but always the right kind of thing for himself. He always tried to get ahead in life by, in this case, joining the Nazi Party.
Is there actually any evidence that he believed in some of these Nazi ideals, though, Philip?
No, I don't think so. I think that he was really an opportunist. He did it to make his life easier.
Okay, and
the Nazi Party was winning elections, so he chose the winning side, so to speak.
Okay, at what stage then did he marry Princess Juliana? Because clearly the Nazi Party changed over the years. Many people may have joined it originally thinking, well, this is a good idea, but then seeing all sorts of, you know, really anti-Semitic stuff, for example, happening in Germany, burning of books and this kind of thing. At what stage during the development of the Nazi Party did he decide to marry into the Dutch royal family?
He probably already in 1934 decided to leave Germany. In his official biography, it says that he told his father on his deathbed that in 1934 that he was leaving Germany and that he was going to live in another country. That's remarkable because at that time there was no I don't think he knew Juliana at that time, let's put it that way. So already in 1934, after he'd become a member of the Nazi Party a year before, he already spoke about joining another, or living in another country, perhaps even joining another army, because the kind of remarks he made to his father on his deathbed are quite ambiguous. So you could also read into it that he was going to join another army, another power in the world.
So he married Princess Juliana, and to what extent was he then, you know, accepted by the Dutch?
Well, remarkably, he was accepted right away. I mean, we're talking about a period in which Nazi Germany was becoming stronger and stronger, but he married into the Dutch royal family, and almost immediately he was seen as a Dutchman. Very few people ever questioned his loyalty to the Dutch state, even though the big neighbor next door, Germany, was becoming more and more aggressive, and I think few people doubted that they would eventually invade the Netherlands. But he was accepted right away. There were almost no voices of dissent at that time. Everybody just assumed that because he was becoming a prince of the Netherlands, he would be a real Dutchman.
Okay, and am I right in thinking that things might have possibly changed in some people's minds anyway when Germany invaded Holland? I think I'm right in saying in 1940.
Yeah, that's even more remarkable. It didn't. The Dutch royal family fled to Great Britain, and the British authorities distrusted him a great deal. I mean, here was a guy arriving in London who just a couple of years before was not only a German but a member of the SS. And here he was in the middle of London, you know, talking to all these governments in exile and becoming a major society figure. So they distrusted him, and they dispatched one of their best intelligence people at that time to keep an eye on him, to report on him. That was Ian Fleming, who would later become very famous for writing all those James Bond spy novels. So the Dutch didn't distrust him, but the British did.
Okay, because I'm surprised to hear that, because I know that King George the VI, you know, he was actually persuaded Ian Fleming, I think, eventually to give Prince Bernhard complete security clearance in Britain, even though he'd been in the SS. He was an ex-SS officer.
Yeah. Well, the British distrust after a while subsided. I mean, for the first year, he was Ian Fleming kept an eye on him. And then finally, Fleming submitted his report to the British authorities, and he said, look, this guy might have been a German. He might have been a member of the SS, but I think he's okay, and I don't think he's a German spy. And at that time, Prince Bernhard was accepted as a Dutchman, so to speak, in London, and he was even the liaison officer for the Dutch government with the British intelligence operations. So from a position where he was greatly distrusted, all of a sudden he became like this very important figure in British and Dutch intelligence work.
Yes, it's like Ian Fleming waved his magic wand over him or something.
Yeah.
He wasn't trusted by everybody, was he?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
He wasn't trusted by everybody.
No, there were still people in British intelligence circles who distrusted him afterwards. But most of the people trusted him, and he kind of earned that trust as well. He stayed in London during the Blitz. He nearly died in a couple of bombing raids by the Germans. So I guess that after a while, because he's a very charming figure. If you talk about people who met him, who were friends with him, everybody always talks about his charm. So I guess he really charmed the British as well into trusting him. So they were, after a while, they were convinced. Most people were convinced, anyway, that he was trustworthy and that he could even be cleared at the highest level to perform intelligence work.
Yeah, but the Americans didn't trust him, and neither did the Admiralty. There were still people who were saying, "Well, look, whatever the King says, whatever Ian Fleming says, it's just not worth the risk to someone that might be a spy."
Yeah, no, that's true. But even after a while, even his those people had to concede that he was probably not a German spy. I mean, obviously, it's strange that you have this guy. He had even in his Dutch, he had a strong German accent. That you have this guy running around London talking to MI5, MI6, the SOE. Yeah, I mean, there you have it. He was after a while, even though there was great distrust, after a while he was trusted and he was allowed to get his pilot's license so he could fly RAF planes. He even went on sorties with the RAF and the American Air Force over occupied France, occupied Holland. So he was, I mean, whatever distrust there was, after a while it really subsided.
Okay, but towards the end of the war, I mean, he had access to all sorts of important circles. I mean, I've seen photographs of him, for example, peering over the shoulder of Monty when he was planning Operation Market Garden, which was one of the most important moves, the liberation of Holland, in fact, after D-Day in September 1944. So what was his role at that point?
As I said, he was a liaison officer. Obviously, it was very important to have communications with the Dutch resistance, and he was one of the people who was in charge of establishing that contact and making sure that the British military and the Dutch resistance knew that from each other what they were doing, and that there was good communications between those two parties. And he was one of the people who was responsible for that.
But it didn't go too well, did it? I mean, there was an agent called Christian Lindemans, I probably pronounced that wrong, I'll let you do it, also known as King Kong.
Yeah, nickname or codename King Kong, yeah. One of the things that you could say about Bernard was that he was not always competent in his role as a master of spies. I mean, the title of my book is Master of Spies, and I think that very often he was, but he had one big flaw, and that was that he was way too trusting of people. I mean, if you became his friend, he would defend you to the death, whatever you did in life. I mean, he would always make excuses for you. Once he had decided that you were okay, he was on your side, and you know, you could do whatever you like. This spy, a man called Christian Lindemans, codenamed King Kong, he met him on his Brussels headquarters after Belgium had been liberated, but the Netherlands had not yet been liberated. And he thought, this guy is okay, he's going to be my friend, and I'm going to trust him. And I'm even going to give him some assignments to do in the occupied Netherlands. I'll send him through the front into the Netherlands to establish a contact with some resistance groups. The only problem was King Kong was also a spy for the Germans. And the very first thing that he did once he crossed those lines was go to the German Abwehr, so the German intelligence organization, and tell him that he had seen some plans in Bernard's headquarters in Brussels for a big air raid and a big a parachute landing in Arnhem, which was known as Operation Market Garden.
So he gave the game away, really, and this guy shouldn't really have been trusted. But, I mean, many people will say, well, that's... well, they will look at Bernard as an ex-SS man and say, well, he would say, I didn't know, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I guess it's more stupidity than evil. it's you know, the thing is that...
Because this was a crucial part of the war, you know, the liberation of Holland. And maybe Bernhard was a good guy, you know, and helping the Dutch all the way through the war, except for the one crucial point.
Yeah. I understand why you would think that. And it is a possibility. You know, the problem is that we don't know the whole story about King Kong. We know about 75-80% of the story. There was a British counterintelligence officer who was trying to get the whole story from King Kong. King Kong was moved after the war to a camp called O2O, which was also known as Ham, code name Ham. It's the place where all German spies were sent to, and once they were caught by the British, and then interrogated. They were trying to interrogate King Kong, and after a while, he was almost ready to break, and then all of a sudden they lost King Kong. He was taken away by it's not fully known who took him, but it's probably by orders of the Dutch government, who said, we want to interrogate him ourselves. And he was taken to Germany, of all places. And what happened next was that King Kong died under circumstances which they're not completely clear. And the big question is, did he die of natural causes? Was there an accident, or was he, you know, so to speak, helped dying? Was he murdered because he knew too much? I think it's the latter. I think he knew too much, and that right before he was ready to spill the beans, all of a sudden he met with an accident and he died. So we don't know the complete story, but that Bernard played a dubious role in this is quite clear to me.
Okay, we'll spin on 10 years or so from the end of the war and Operation Market Garden to 1954 in the exact same spot as what was called the Witch's Cauldron, where thousands of British airborne troops, the parachute regiment, were massacred by the Nazis, including flame-throwing tanks, Tiger tanks, over several days in a place called Oosterbeek. 10 years later, the very first ever Bilderberg meeting, and there's Bernhard sitting in the chair.
Yeah. Bernard, after the war, he looked for things to do. I mean, he had a clear role, a clear objective during the war, which was being a liaison officer. And then the war ended, and he was looking for a new job, so to speak. So one of the things that he did, he had very good contacts because of the war with the intelligence community in Britain and America. And as the 50s started, Europe and America started to drift apart, and especially people in the intelligence community worried about it. And one of those people who worried about it was Bernard. So they came up with a plan to bring together people from the United States, politicians, people from large companies, to bring them together and try to, you know, clear the air, so to speak. Let people speak their minds about each other's countries and clear the air, so to speak. So,
well, that's one view, but if I can just stop you, and there is another view,
yeah, sure.
And that is that the US, the Council on Foreign Relations, back in 1943, the War and Peace Studies Group, had identified that they were going to win the war, that the Germans were going to lose, but they wanted to make sure that many of the European countries didn't drift towards communism, drift towards the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so I wonder what you make of that reason for the group's existence.
I was getting there. it's true. The fear of communism in Europe played a major role in that. Bernard was vehemently anti-communist. He did several interviews in the press in which he made really scathing remarks about communists. He talked to the Americans that he thought that communism was one of the biggest threats to continental Europe. And yeah, obviously one of the reasons to have the Bilderberg Conference was to try to fight communism. One of the plans was to include people from Eastern Europe at first. So, there was definitely this anti-communism part of these conferences.
Okay, and also 20 years he chaired these meetings. It moved, I suppose, from a more informal group into something which had become more to do with the military-industrial complex and banking, finance. And then in 1975 there was the Lockheed scandal. Can you just tell us about that, how it happened and what it was about?
What happened was that Bernard was not only chairman of the Bilderberg Conference, he was also in charge of the Dutch military. And in that capacity, one of the very important roles that he had was deciding which aircraft the Dutch Air Force was going to buy. At that time, we're talking about the 50s and the 60s, the Dutch Air Force was buying the Lockheed Starfighter. And in the 70s, as it turned out, Bernard had received $1.1 million to see to it from Lockheed, to see to it that the Dutch Air Force did buy the Starfighter. And actually, it was the Americans who found it out. They had hearings at a committee that looked into all kinds of allegations of bribery. And then all of a sudden, Bernard's name came up when somebody from the Lockheed Group testified. And then his game was up. I mean, people in the Netherlands noticed that his name had been mentioned, and they tried to investigate him here as well.
Okay, so what was the scandal like there in Holland, and how was was Bernhard's reputation then in tatters?
It was, yeah. I mean, you could argue that it was almost the end of the monarchy in this country, because Juliana, the Queen, his wife of some 30 years at that time, threatened that if Bernard was ever arrested or convicted by a court in the Netherlands, she would no longer be queen. And her daughter, Beatrix, who would later become queen, also in private meetings with politicians, also stated that she also didn't want to become queen if her father was arrested. So had that happened, and it didn't in the end, we would have been without a monarchy.
Interesting that they should take such extreme measures. And of course, Beatrix went on to, nicknamed Queen Bee, went on to take a very big part in the Bilderberg conferences. What is their relationship with the Shell company? Because we often hear it called Royal Dutch Shell, don't we?
Yeah. Well, the name Royal doesn't say anything per se. I mean, lots of companies in Holland are named Royal. The thing that you have to do is you have to be in existence for more than a century, and you have to be a reputable company, and then you can get this moniker Royal. I mean, there's also Royal Dutch Airlines, and there's one of the supermarkets that I usually go to. They're also known as Royal. So Royal in itself is doesn't say a lot, but Royal Dutch Shell is remarkable because they got this name Royal right from the start. So not after 100 years of existence, but right at the start. And one of the investors was one of the Dutch kings, King William III, and he invested a great deal of money into this company, and they've been stockholders ever since.
Okay, including Beatrix.
Yeah, I mean those shares have been, passed from generation to generations, and it's probably now somewhere around 1.5 or 2% of the stock.
Okay, so Bernhard died in 2004. How is he now remembered in Holland?
That's very difficult to. It's very difficult to answer that question. I think that especially the older generation, people who've been in the war. I mean, there's less and less of them. Obviously, they still hold him in high regard. But I think that people from my generation and younger. I'm 46. They tend to see him for what he was, which is an opportunist. I mean, he was. Whatever he did for himself. Even the Bilderberg Conference, one of the complaints of other participants was that Bernard was always trying to, do some business there, always try to make a deal with the other participants. He was always trying to make money. He had a very expensive lifestyle. He had some illegitimate children. He had a mother to take care of. So he was always trying to make some money. And that is, I think, the Bernard that we will eventually remember, the guy who basically did everything to earn a few bob.
And what about Bilderberg today? We've heard recently that that it's going to be taking place in Copenhagen, in Denmark, not too far away from you, and also that there is a big deal which the Bilderbergers are trying to push through called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP. Essentially, what it would mean would be that if there's legislation passed in any European or US state or country that goes against what the agreement has said, that is to say, threatens the profits of a big corporation, that actually that government will be sued by the corporation and they can take that to court. Now, what this seems to do, it seems to me, is to actually to put the corporations in the driving seat, not the people or the parliament. And I mean, that's essentially what the situation is in the EU, where you've got the European Commission, which is, you know, seems to represent corporations more than it represents ordinary people, and the parliament is in the sidelines. Anyway, I just wonder what your thoughts are about the Bilderberg today in the context of the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership and other sorts of things that are going on in the modern world.
Yeah, I've heard those stories as well. Obviously, we will never know exactly what happens at Bilderberg. Sometimes years later, you can see some transcripts. So we will never know for sure what is going to be discussed there. But that there is talk about this huge free trade area, including Europe and America. Yeah, that is in the works. I mean, we can clearly see indications of that. Whether that is going to be discussed at this year's Bilderberg and even where it's held. I mean, you talk about Copenhagen, but I've also heard some rumors that it's actually going to be in the Netherlands this year. So this whole secrecy is one of the things that I really don't like about Bilderberg. I mean, I'm all for transparency, especially when it comes to politics. So to have this group of politicians and business people together talking about things that we're not supposed to know about, I mean, that as a journalist, certainly that is something that I really don't like.
Philip Drucker, I hope I've pronounced it right, did I? No, wrong. Okay. Can you just pronounce it correctly for me? So maybe next time if we speak again.
Okay, it's Drucker.
Drucker, okay, Philip Drucker.
It's German. Like Bernard, I'm a closet German. My ancestors were from Germany. It's with an O with an umlaut, so two dots on the O, which makes an U sound.
All right, Philip. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us on the Politics Show this evening. And hopefully at some point your book will be translated into English. Any prospect of that?
Not at this time, but who knows? I mean, maybe your radio show, somebody in the publishing industry is listening and thinks that's a really good idea. So
okay, that would be great, because it was a bestseller in Holland, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I was actually on the number one spot a couple of years ago.
Okay, Philip, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
It was my pleasure.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, that was fascinating stuff from the past, but right in the present we've got this whole situation going on in Ukraine, and we're going to hear in a minute from the local MP Liam Fox at Prime Minister's Questions talking about it. What's your take on what's the developments this week?
Well, this afternoon I understand fighting is going on in Slovyansk between the Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian militias. And that's a rather worrying development, because probably we're just going to escalate from here.
I mean, we're supposed to be having an election any time now, aren't we? So what's
May
the situation
25th,
with that?
Supposedly. Well, I think the Russian government have said, you know, calling an election in the middle of
is there any way for the Kiev government to actually encourage and create a situation where they can have an election when you've got occupied parts of the country and occupied government buildings,
well,
police stations,
etc.? That's a $64,000 question, isn't it? You know, there's going to be an election in Syria, for example, in June. Can you have an election in the middle of a civil war? I don't know. The thing is, if you don't have an election, then the civil war is all there is. And if you have an election in the middle of a civil war, so there are a lot of problems with that. I wish that everybody on all sides would be calmer about this, but I'm afraid the West seems to be determined to create a confrontational situation in East Ukraine, and the people of Ukraine will be the losers.
Well, as I said, it was discussed at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Susan Gilmore saying that, asking the Prime Minister, David Cameron, about what his thoughts were about Alex Salmond, the leader of the Scottish National Party's admiration of Vladimir Putin.
Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday, Ukrainians in Scotland wrote to Alex Salmond expressing disgust and astonishment at the First Minister's statement that he admired President Putin. Will the Prime Minister support the statements of the Scottish-Ukrainian community and the state and Labour in condemning those statements which support a regime which oppresses its own minority groups and silences its critics?
I agree wholeheartedly with the Honourable Lady. I think that what Alex Salmond said was a major error of judgment. I think all of us in this House should be supporting the Ukrainian desire to be a sovereign, independent country and to have the respect of the international community and party leaders for that ambition.
Martin.
Well, I mean, all this stuff about why we've got to support the government in Ukraine. The government in Ukraine came to power through a violent coup. Snipers shot dead protesters and police officers, and we've got a telephone intercept from Umas Piets, who's the foreign minister of Estonia, speaking to Catherine Ashton of the EU, saying on the day that the coup took place, we suspect that this is being carried out by elements within the current government, not the pro-Russian government, the current government, were responsible for shooting those demonstrators and the police officers. Now, in other words, the Russians are facing a situation where NATO special forces have probably been killing people in Kiev. Now, I suspect that ultimately the Kiev government, the Kiev junta, will collapse because the policies they're pursuing of privatisation, increasing people's gas bills, cutting their benefits, essentially structural adjustment, shock therapy, is going to be disastrous for the East Ukraine, but it's going to be equally disastrous for the West Ukraine. This regime will collapse. The Russians aren't going anywhere. Putin, for all the huffing and puffing, has got far higher popular support in Russia and in East Ukraine than Alex Salmond or David Cameron or Ed Miliband. The latest opinion polls in Russia give Putin 80% support for what he's doing. David Cameron, we'll see in 2015. But it's nothing like 80%, is it? Or for Obama, or for any of these Western politicians.
Well, the North Somerset Conservative MP, Liam Fox, disgraced from his job as Defence Secretary, also weighed in on the Ukraine and Russia debate at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Speaker, from the cyber attack on Estonia to the invasion of Georgia to recent events in the Crimea, we've seen a clear pattern of behaviour from the Kremlin. And the West has allowed itself to allow wishful thinking to take the place of critical analysis. Given that defence exports from the EU to Russia have amounted to about 700 million euros in the last 3 years, not counting the 1.2 billion order for French warships, isn't it about time that these were targeted for EU sanctions?
No, I think my right honourable friend is absolutely right on this issue. We have set out a clear set of sanctions in terms of Russia's behaviour towards Ukraine. We've taken a series of steps so far in terms of putting asset freezes and travel bans on named individuals. We've taken a series of diplomatic and other steps, and we've set out the so-called Stage 3 sanctions that we think should be taken if further incursions and further destabilisation of South and Eastern Ukraine are set out. And we do believe that restrictions on arms sales should certainly be part.
Martin, the Prime Minister's talking about incursions there. Is there actually any evidence that the Russian troops are helping? I mean, you're accusing NATO of helping the right-wing government or the new government taking over in Kiev. But is there any evidence the other way around that the Russians are actually helping the, maybe with arms or whatever?
I would be extremely surprised. I would be extremely surprised if everybody hasn't got their spies crawling all over the Ukraine. I used to work in that part of the world. I used to work in Lithuania. I was in Armenia. I was in Russia. and basically the whole region is crawling with intelligence agencies of all kinds. I mean, Liam Fox, of course, was pushed out of the government because he and his chum Werity were in cahoots with the Israelis, who, of course, are still holding territory in the West Bank. Are we going to... When are the sanctions on Israel coming?
What possible interest have the Israelis got in what happens in Ukraine, though?
Well, don't forget that this is also a counter-move to what happened over Syria last year, when Putin basically, in alliance with Assad, prevented the West from attacking Syria, because he basically, as Nigel Farage pointed out when he was debating with Nick Clegg, the evidence is now piling up that the chemical weapons attack in Damascus, which was supposedly a red line...
That's Ghouta.
The Ghouta, yeah. Simon Hirsch wrote an article in the London Review of Books, which I think is pretty definitive, the Red Line and the Rat Line, which shows that it was in fact the rebels that used chemical weapons, the Turks in particular, working with the Saudis, who work with MI6. So it's quite possible that there is some British intelligence officer who was involved in using chemical weapons in Syria. Now, when we were saying that the Assad was using chemical weapons in Syria, we were going to bomb the hell out of them. Now, what are we going to do if MI6 were involved and the CIA involved in using chemical weapons in Syria? Maybe we need the police service of Northern Ireland to arrest them instead of Gerry Adams.
Now, the Russians have got very upset over the last couple of weeks because apparently some agreements, I think it was a Montreux agreement, possibly, that was about how many NATO warships were allowed in the Black Sea. More warships, guided missile destroyers, this kind of thing, are coming through the Bosphorus and into the Black Sea. Now, this is obviously ramping up tension. We've also had US forces being moved from one part of Europe to another, some being brought across from the US into NATO positions, which are in NATO countries, but they're quite close to Ukraine.
Yes, and various politicians have been going on about what we've got. Let's make this absolutely clear. Ukraine is not in NATO. Ukraine is not in NATO, so there is absolutely no...
But they
NATO
might do joint exercises with NATO, possibly.
Well, they might, but there's no treaty obligation on NATO to defend the Ukraine, none whatsoever. And the politicians in the Ukraine know that very well.
Okay, well, also, on another programme that I do, it's called Dialect, on a Tuesday morning, a few weeks ago, and maybe I didn't really quite understand the significance of it at the time. I spoke to a war gamer, that is a war game designer, called Joseph Miranda. He designed a series of games, including one called The Battle for Baghdad, which apparently was very popular in the Pentagon back in 2000, and another one was called Millennium Wars Ukraine, and I spoke to him about that a couple of weeks ago. So let's hear from US war game designer Joseph Miranda now, because in many ways, the precursors to these wars are the games. If it looks like you can keep winning the game, the temptation, of course, is let's do a real war.
The game is called Ukraine. It's done by One Small Step Games. We're going to be doing an update on it.
Just imagine you are playing it now. What would you be doing if you were the West, looking at what's actually going on in the real world for a change?
Well, I think it's extremely doubtful that we'll see NATO marching into the Ukraine. If there is an attempt to influence things, it will be done through information operations or manipulating non-governmental organizations, and that's where the real struggle is going to become. And of course, the Russians are showing themselves to be very adept at this. They have conducted cyber warfare, and they apparently can get people out there, paramilitaries out there in the streets fighting for them. So this whole other front that's going on.
I mean, are the West the good guys and the Russians the bad guys? Is it really as simple as that?
Well, I don't get into a political opinion here. I can think of myself as sort of a detached observer here. Certainly people have been struggling for the Ukraine since the days of the Scythians, and this is not going to be the end of this struggle there.
Also, in your game, Ukraine, the idea of information warfare, IOPS, information operations, how do you actually bring that into the game? How does it work in the game?
Well, there are several ways I've done this. One is by using cards, so you have a card representing different kinds of information operations. Another is to have game pieces which represent different kinds of information warfare technologies. So, for example, you might have pieces representing cyber war, others representing media access, others representing crashing enemy systems. So you're fighting on all fronts. And again, the thing that's kind of interesting, of course, is most of this is non-lethal. And it's taking place in the background, in the shadows, so...
Knowing that these information operations are going on, do you think it affects the way you interpret what you're seeing on the TV, on the radio, reading in the newspapers about a real-life event?
Yes, I think there's a lot more propaganda going on today than during the Cold War, actually. And a lot of the problem is that because everything is instantaneous, reporting often is chasing ratings or trying to gain public popularity, but it's not actually giving reporting. I'll say something that many people find shocking, but I don't have a television because I feel that as long as you're plugged into television, you're not quite getting an accurate picture of what's going on.
Well, that's a salutary note there from the war game designer. You're not getting an accurate picture of what's going on if you're watching television, Martin. But he's saying there things like denying the other side access to the media. This means that actually what's going on here is largely, or a large part of it, is a media war. He's also saying things like if you're going to have a battle, make sure it takes place in the countryside where not a lot of people are witnessing it.
Well, that seems to be what's going on around Slovyansk this afternoon. And let me repeat again. We have a telephone intercept which Umas Piets, the foreign minister of Estonia, has told Agence France-Presse is a genuine phone call where he tells Catherine Ashton, the head of the EU's foreign service, that the shootings in the Maidan Square that killed the protesters, which led to the coup, were carried out by the current government. And I suspect the current government didn't do it on their own. They did it as part of NATO's Gladio networks, which have been carrying out terrorist attacks in West and in Eastern Europe since the 1970s, including the bombing of Bologna Railway Station and the bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969. We repeat these things again and again on this show. NATO is a terrorist organisation, and I want to see the police service of Northern Ireland arresting some of the terrorists in NATO before they start messing around with Gerry Adams.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, the book's called NHS PLC, The Privatisation of Our Healthcare. And Alison Pollock, Professor Alison Pollock, is the author of it, was in Bath yesterday, where I spoke to her about why she thinks the NHS really has been, already has been, privatised.
My name's Professor Alison Pollock. I'm a Professor of Public Health Policy and Research, and I work at Queen Mary University of London. I'm in Bath to give a lecture tonight on the abolition of the National Health Service.
Because that's something that, for example, Liberal Democrats and Conservatives will say is just a misnomer. It's just the commissioning that's changing, not the health service itself, that is still going to be the same principles as it was founded after World War II.
Well, we have to go back to the founding legislation of the National Health Service, and the founding legislation imposes a duty on the Secretary of State for Health to secure and provide comprehensive healthcare for all citizens throughout England. It's that duty that has now been abolished. So there is no longer a duty, a ministerial duty, to secure and provide universal healthcare for all. And the government has passed a major act of parliament which abolishes the NHS, and it has 457 pages. And the reason why it needed the 457 pages, because in addition to abolishing the NHS, it's now moving towards a full market in healthcare. So it's breaking up the NHS and bringing in private commercial providers who will increasingly have the ability to determine who gets care and what services will be provided.
Now, for many people, they'll say, well, actually, my GP service, the service in hospital, is just the same as it's always been at the moment.
For a while it will be, because there's still over £110 billion of funds coming into NHS-funded services. But what's happening is that the English NHS is being remodelled along American lines, so that the NHS will simply be a payment stream which is flowing to a variety of private for-profit providers.
So where will the signs start to appear of this US-style system coming in here in Britain?
Initially, what patients will find is that they may find some of their GP practices closing, and so that it's increasingly more difficult to get a general practitioner, especially in the inner city areas. But on top of that, they may find that increasingly some services will no longer be available provided by the NHS, and these are likely to be a range of community services. So there will be a reduction in the provision of things like occupational therapy, physiotherapy and speech therapy services. But in addition to that, they may find it harder and harder to get the treatments that they need, such as elective surgery for hips or for cataracts.
Now, I know some of the basic services, things like, for example, hernia operations, have already been privatised. They're being done by private health providers like Care UK, for example. How are those services, as they're delivered, different to the old NHS? Is there really any difference?
Well, there are two key differences. One is that the private for-profit sector has cherry-picked the healthy patients and the profitable services, leaving the sick and the unwell and the vulnerable and the elderly for the NHS to pick up, which means that the NHS is left with the higher risk patients. Now, this has two effects. One, it destabilizes NHS hospitals, and secondly, it has an impact on the training and education of staff. But the third thing to remember is if you go into a private for-profit hospital, they don't have all the backup that's needed should you fall critically ill or sick. So if there are complications, if you know you need to go to intensive care, then you simply are whisked back into the NHS for your treatment again. So in fact, the private for-profit sector is protected from all the risks and costs of care, and the government is picking up all the litigation and all the liabilities.
So is there any real prospect of preserving the old-fashioned NHS, which was, after all, put together after World War II, when people realised if you're dragging an injured body out of a bombed building in the Blitz, then you really don't want to be asking too many questions about how much you can pay. You just want to get that person better.
This is a political decision. The government in England has made a decision that it no longer wants to afford a national health service, and it also has made a political decision to change the basis of funding, because when it took away the duty on the Secretary of State to secure and provide universal health care for all, it opened up the prospect of raising funds from out-of-pocket payments, user charges, and also private health insurance. So private providers in a marketplace want to have the ability to ration NHS-funded care and introduce new charges for treatments. So what will happen is you come into a hospital, they'll offer you a small range of treatments that are available on the NHS, and then they'll begin to offer you a whole range of other treatments that you can pay if you're willing and able to pay. This is deeply inequitable, and it creates a multi-tier system and a race to the bottom, and it's very, very then difficult to monitor whether the care that you're getting is actually the care that you need, and it breaks with public trust. But the most important thing to remember is that it's not because we can't afford it. We're still one of the richest countries in the world. We absolutely can afford it. The government has made a decision that we should no longer have a national health service, and that's a political decision it's made. The second myth that we're always told is that we've got an ageing population. Now, this is true. We have got an increasing number of older people. But report after report after report has shown this is not the catastrophe that the politicians like to say it is. Far from it. If you keep older people healthy and well and they live longer, then they are not a drain on the National Health Service. Indeed, most of the costs of healthcare are incurred in the last 6 months of your life. So if you die when you're 15 or 30 or 45 or 70, the costs are in the last 6 months of your life and not as a result of being simply older. So there are a lot of myths. We do not have this demographic time bomb that the government talks about, and we absolutely can afford it. And it's a needless scandal that the government has abolished the NHS when actually it's a very, very vital bit of our social contract of what people feel means to be British.
Also, the US, you're saying we're going down this line, it's worth looking over the United States at problems with their system, because they may be arriving here soon. What sort of problems are there in the US?
Well, the government is remodelling the National Health Service in England along US lines. Now, in the US, there are 60 million people without any access to healthcare. That is the equivalent of the whole population of England. And two-thirds of all bankruptcies are due to medical healthcare bills. People don't make any decisions in their lives about changing jobs in case it affects their healthcare status. And it's quite catastrophic. It's also the most expensive system in the world, so it takes 18% of gross domestic product, compared with our system, which is between 8 and 9% of GDP. So what we're going to have is enormous inefficiencies. We're going to get over-treatment and under-treatment, overcharging and billing and invoicing and marketing and all the costs that come with a market that are not associated with a public healthcare system. It's grossly inefficient, the American healthcare system, and it's the most unfair and most inequitable system in the whole of the Western world. I've worked on NHS privatisation for over 20 years. I've written a book called NHS PLC, The Privatisation of Our Healthcare. All my work has been on the private finance initiative. It's been difficult work because for a long time, nobody, especially the politicians, didn't actually like the analysis or want to believe the analysis, especially when New Labour was in power. So that was particularly difficult to get the work published and out in the public domain. But now we've come to a really critical stage where the NHS has now been abolished and there are campaigns all over the country mobilizing. So I'm sad to say that my analysis of 20 years has been proven right. May the 7th is a very important day because the Care Bill goes back to the House of Lords. And there are a number of very critical amendments to do with hospital closures, but also to do what's happening to patient data. Because one of the problems is that for 60 years, we have given our data to doctors and health professionals in trust that it will be the confidentiality will be respected and it won't be sold on or commercially exploited. So for 60 years, the government has taken great care of our data and it's only used for planning and research and needs assessment. Now what's happened over the last 10 years, but since the Health and Social Care Act, is that increasingly the government sees data as an income stream, an asset to be traded in the marketplace. And what's actually happening is that our patient data are being commercialized and they're being sold on and sold off to big companies without our consent and without our knowledge. So because of this, the British Medical Association, Med Confidential, and the Royal College of GPs have had a big campaign saying we need to opt out of the new system where the government wanted to collect all the GP data and bring it together and link it to hospital data. Patients were being told that they should opt out. Now, because the government was worried about losing the data, it's actually paused this new system called care.data and promised to bring forward new amendments. We've seen the government pause before during the passage of the Health and Social Care Bill 2 years ago, when actually they did nothing to alleviate our concerns. And now what we see is during this pause, they've tabled an amendment which is next to useless. So myself and a number of colleagues have put together three amendments which should go into the Care Bill and which could be used to safeguard patient data and restore public trust. But if the government does not accept these amendments, then we are into a very critical situation where our data, which will increasingly be in the hands of private companies, because when you go to a private company for your NHS treatment, they receive your data and they can pass it on and parcel it on. What we need is checks on them being able to do anything that will commercially exploit our data, because the data that's generated between the patient and doctor is a very special piece of data and information. It's generated in trust. It's when we're at our most vulnerable that we give our data, and actually it's when we tell all the secrets. So it's very, very different from data, for example, that goes to supermarkets, for example. So I think it's very important that people are aware of the care.data, they're aware of the issues, and that actually we need a year to get this right. We must get the legislation right, but in the meanwhile, we need to stop the commercial for-profit sector from extracting our data and use it for marketing and targeting and commercial purposes. purposes, which could ultimately also result in the denial of some of us getting a denial of care.
They're saying that this will be all anonymous, anonymised.
Well, there are two issues. Data can have all the identifiers stripped off them, as in national statistics, and they're aggregate and anonymised. But when you want to link different data sets, you have to strip off the identifiers, but you still need to be able to have what's called pseudo-identifiers to link them. But it is actually possible, using what's called pseudo-anonymised data, to identify individuals. Now, that's very, very worrying, especially as we're moving into a marketplace where the private sector will want to target us for goods and services that we may not need. So they will be very interested in whether we can afford to pay, for example, and whether they can actually target us and use marketing methods. Now, that's something that's never happened in the National Health Service. But a second real risk is that private sector is risk averse. So they will want to limit their risks, which means that they will want to limit the amount of care they give us. And those data, again, will be used to identify high-risk groups, such as the elderly, vulnerable people, people with mental health problems. They'll want to target them so that they can begin to either restrict their liability for care and offer either private treatments or reduce the availability of care so that they don't have to have responsibility for patients. And this is a very well-known tactic. It happens all the time in the US. So it's not a conspiracy. It's just business. It's just the way business works.
That was Alison Pollock there. You spell her name A-L-L-Y-S-O-N. P-O-L-L-O-C-K. You can follow her on Twitter, and also her book is called NHS PLC, The Privatisation of Our Healthcare. And she's writing a book coming out at the end of next year, Martin, The End of the NHS. Ultimately, this is a betrayal, surely, of what happened after World War II.
Indeed it is. And of course, the problem is that once it's done, it's done. It's very difficult to reconstruct it.
Why is it that you think that, what's the motivation behind this? She's talking about the US system being replicated here.
Well, it's private vested interests and private profit. And, of course, basically getting us all to understand that things that we used to think we were going to get, we're not going to get.
OK, time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 time. We hope Cyrus the Virus and his typical topical Afro-tropical shows up next. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Rob Telford. And I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. Don't let the banksters get you down. Have a good bank holiday weekend. See you soon.
3.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the judge who's jailed celebrity publicist Max Clifford for historical indecent assault has described him as having a contemptuous attitude. The 71-year-old's been given an 8-year sentence, half of which he'll have to serve before he's eligible for parole. Speaking outside Southwark Crown Court, DCI Michael Orchard from the Metropolitan Police praised those who gave evidence.
I would like to again thank all of the victims for their bravery in coming forward. Without their support, we would not have secured these successful convictions, and I commend them for their courage, strength and confidence in us that they would be listened to.
Police in South Wales are investigating an alleged plot by two teenage girls to kill a teacher.